Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. A recent survey by Cigna Health Insurance found that younger Americans were lonelier than older Americans. And you might ask, how can that be? Sarah Conrath, a professor at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, recently wrote about the study and what it means for the conversation. We'll post a link to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The study was conducted by the health insurance company Cigna. What did you find that caught your eye?
Well, I had just written this. I'm writing a book on empathy and social connection over time, and I had just written this section on the book about loneliness over time, changes in generations. And I read sort of something different than what I saw in the study.
You wrote that the idea of loneliness is subjective. Contrast that with the idea of isolation and why it matters.
Yeah, so social isolation is more objective. It's things like living alone or having very few social ties or not feeling comfortable talking to people about important issues. Loneliness is just the feeling of being unhappy about one social situation. And you can be lonely when you're alone, but also when you're with people.
Like at a big party where you don't know anybody.
Yeah, or even, you know, like on average, married people are less lonely than unmarried people. But of course, people in bad marriages are more lonely.
Loneliness and isolation affect us in different ways. What's the difference?
Well, actually, they're both bad for our physical health.
Okay.
So, for example, both loneliness and social isolation are associated with between 25 to 30% risk of death, even in people. Basically, loneliness is more dangerous than obesity, and it's about as deadly as smoking.
Why is that? What physiologically is going on that would make it more deadly than obesity and what was the other one?
Smoking.
Smoking. I mean, my goodness.
Yeah, I think it has to do with just what's happening physiologically in terms of our need for connection, because when we're lonely or isolated, our bodies are actually meant biologically to be close to people, and we end up having higher stress hormones when we're apart. We also have less bonding hormones. We have more.
I've been losing you, so can you repeat that?
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, on a cell phone. Basically, our bodies have trouble fighting infections. We have more inflammation, more stress hormones, and less bonding hormones when we're not with others, because biologically we are meant to be together.
Is that changing over time to be more common?
So the survey that was done by Cigna said that younger generations are more lonely, but it's just a one-time survey.
Uh-huh.
So it's just really just asking people now, like, how lonely are you? But I've actually found research that tracks people over time. So actually says, okay, 20-year-old college students or high school students, what were they like, you know, 20 years ago compared to now? And actually what you find is nowadays, the current generation compared to older previous generations mm-hmm. actually are saying they're less lonely at the same age.
And what do you make of that?
Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, it does. But what do you make of it?
Well, it's hard to know what to make of it, but I also want to say that at the same time, they are saying that they're more socially isolated. So they have fewer people that they're interacting with.
Uh-huh.
Loneliness, to me, it's like a social hunger. Like, it's important to be aware that you're hungry, because then you're going to go eat food, right? And loneliness is a signal that there's something wrong, so that you go out and interact with people. And I wonder if it's a problem that there's declining loneliness, because maybe people aren't, they're becoming more isolated, but they're not noticing or caring the same way as they used to.
Huh. Ergo, your book that you're writing about changes over time in empathy and social connection.
Yes, exactly.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the contrast and comparing loneliness and isolation. My guest is Sarah Conrath. She's an assistant professor of philanthropic studies at Indiana University, Purdue University in Indianapolis. What do you think about the contrast between lonely and isolation and the feeling of being isolated? 614-292-8513. You're an assistant professor of philanthropic studies. I always am curious when I hear about what people are studying. What's the connection between philanthropy and the feelings of loneliness and isolation?
That's a great question. I think many people think of philanthropy as only, you know, about asking for money. But I see it differently. I see it as a literal definition. It's the love of humanity. And I think the connection, when you define it that way, is pretty clear. I also see it as, we define it as voluntary action for the public good. People who are more willing to think about others and care for others generally are less lonely, because obviously when they're giving and caring, other people want to be part of their lives and give back to them.
We read about those studies and we always find them fascinating, that people with lower incomes tend to give a larger percentage of their income to charity, to others, that kind of a thing. Is there a connection there?
Yes, there is. You're right that people do give less, or people who have lower incomes give more. And research also shows that higher income people show less compassion, which I think is concerning. So I think that it's possible that as we get more resources and richer, that we can become a little more isolated, because we can just go pay for things that we need rather than rely on each other.
Do the reasons people feel lonely today differ from the reasons they felt lonely 50 years ago? Do you have any insights on that?
I don't have any studies that look at the reasons people feel lonely over time. Obviously, we can talk about changes that have happened within, especially with media. I think a lot of people want to say that media, social media, makes us lonelier. But I think it's much more complicated than that.
Why?
Because people can use it in different ways, right? So you can have the person who's using it as a way to avoid interacting with others, but you can also have the person who says, hey, I want to meet up with you, or hey, I'm checking in, are you doing okay? And those are really different ways of using it. One of those ways is going to make people feel lonely, or going to make them feel worse. And then if you're actually active and caring on social media, I just think that would extend into your real life relationships.
What are the different impacts of feeling lonely? You know, when you talk about those risks and the 25 to 35% higher risk of death for people who suffer from loneliness, is that looking at older people with loneliness, or does that rate stand up with younger people as well?
That's an overall rate that includes both older and younger people.
Uh-huh.
And it also includes, it's isolation and loneliness. So both, regardless of whether, you know, it's not just the feelings of not feeling connected, but it's actually even if you are also, living alone or not with others. But it includes both younger and older. And a study found actually that it's even stronger among young adults. And I think that's the case because they're less likely to die to begin with. So you'll see bigger effects of certain things that lead to mortality.
An interesting piece of all of this is the issue of confidence, that Americans have fewer confidence. Tell us what we know about that and how Americans compare to others. I guess we want to say in the developed world kind of a thing.
Well, I don't know much about how Americans compare to others, or other cultures. That's a good question. But we do know over time there's been a change. So in 1985, the General Social Survey asked people, how many people do you have you could talk to about important matters? And people, on average, Americans said 2.94, and only 10% of them said that they had zero people to talk about or to talk to about important matters. In 2004, they asked the same question, and now the average number was just around two people that they said they could talk to. So it went down about by one person, but around 25% of Americans said they had no one to talk to.
That concerns you.
That concerns me so much, yes. It makes me sad, actually.
Yeah, it makes me sad, too. Is there a solution to all of this? So, you know, people who feel connected to the world, who feel empathetic about the world around them and other people, they want to help. Is this reflected anywhere in our society that you're seeing that people in general are giving less and care less?
Yes. In fact, a new paper just came out yesterday that found, that is also by my colleague Patrick Rooney and others, that found that generationally there have been declines in giving to charity. So millennials, so Generation X, when they were between age 25 to 31, 49% of them gave to charity. And then millennials at the same age, only 37% gave to charity. And they also gave less than Generation X at the same age. So there's declines in that. In my book, I'm also reviewing declines in empathy. There's been declines in helping behavior over time. And one of the only changes we see in the positive direction is that younger generations are more likely to volunteer. But at the same time, there's been a big rise in the percentage of high schools that require it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, and right now at this point, it's a correlation. It's not a causation that you know of, right?
Yes, I mean, we're just tracking trends over time. We don't know why they exist, but we can just say this is an issue, and if social isolation is higher, we need to address it because it affects health.
Are there any good longitudinal studies on this topic?
There are some, yes. Mostly, I think, to my knowledge, looking at older adults. But It's funny, I actually just happened to get into this topic of loneliness and isolation from my main research in empathy. It kind of led me down this path. So I have a lot to learn still.
What do you want to know? What are the big questions you're asking?
Well, I really don't understand why there'd be a decline in loneliness across the generations, but a rise in isolation. I mean, to me, I think it's not what I expect. It's not what most people think. We think that empathy is declining and narcissism increasing, therefore loneliness should increase. So why are younger generations like satisfied with fact that they're actually less alone, more alone? Like they have less social connections, and why are they okay with that?
And do you have any theories?
I think it has a little bit to do with other findings that we've seen on, for example, changes over time in trust. There's been a decline in trust, and I've also found there's a decline in attachment, which is just basically the feeling of whether you should interact with others and whether they're safe. And young people are less likely to think other people are safe. So I think that there's this just fear happening, this fear of deep connections. Maybe that's what we should help work on if we're going to intervene somewhere.
The feelings of safe, it's interesting. I was just noticing there's a new, I don't know if it's Netflix or what, show about titled Safe.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's about some kind of gated community in England. It's suspenseful and all that kind of stuff. But it makes me wonder, is media playing a role in this?
It's very hard to tell, right? Because so many other things have changed at the same time. Changes in parenting, family sizes, changes in the school systems. There's so many different things that could have fed into why we are now more disconnected than we've ever been.
Well, Sarah Conrath, I want to thank you for depressing me.
I'm sorry. I'm actually a very optimistic person. And I just want you to know that I've been actually using mobile phones to try to increase empathy, because even though I don't think that's necessarily the best way we can do it, I don't think it's all dark. And I think that we can all decide to make this important and find ways to infuse social connection in our life. It is a choice.
What do you mean you're using mobile phones to do that?
Oh, so I created two different programs. One's daily text messages just to remind people to think about others, pay attention to them. And then the other one is an empathy app called Random App of Kindness. And both of them are just designed to help build empathy in young people.
All right. Well, maybe we can get links to those and post them on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Anyways, Sarah Conrath, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
You're welcome. I hope I don't leave you too depressed.
No, I'm good. Sarah Conrath is an assistant professor of philanthropic studies at Indiana University, Purdue University in Indianapolis. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure started 36 years ago with one event and fewer than 1,000 participants. This year, 140 races are scheduled across the country with nearly 1 million participants in all. We wanted to talk about the rate of breast cancer and how that's changed in Ohio compared to the rest of the country. Joining us is the Director of Mission and Strategy for Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure, Columbus affiliate, Julie McMahon. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
The Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure is this Saturday, May 19th in Columbus. Check out our website at WOSU.org/allsides for links to more information about that. What do we know about breast cancer rates in general? Are they up or down or staying stable? What do we know?
Well, the incidence of breast cancer is pretty stable. We're not seeing more people diagnosed in the last 35 years. There was sort of an artificial bump when mammography really was taken up around the country because we were finding more cases back in the 70s and 80s. But the mortality rate has gone down 38% in the last 30 years or so. So we've seen a lot of progress, mostly from new treatments and better quality of care. Our ability to identify subtypes of breast cancer, because there are many different types. And each requires a lot of a whole different path of treatment. So as we've gotten better and better at that, we've treated more cancers and the survival rate has gone up a lot.
Are we looking at treatments and living with it versus a cure actually nowadays?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that up. We're definitely looking at trying to make breast cancer for those who have advanced stages of disease where it's progressed and surgery isn't an option. We're trying to make that a chronic condition that someone can live with for their whole life and as long as possible instead of something that they die from.
When you talk about the number of people that are participating in the race every year, is there a sense about how many people are survivors themselves versus how many people are running in memory of somebody or in honor of somebody?
Yeah, we actually track the number of survivors because we have a special recognition for people who are either current patients or have survived and are living their lives after a diagnosis. So I think this year we have about 1,000 survivors we're anticipating to be there. We've had as many as 2,000 before. Our estimate is there's about 100,000 to 130,000 people who are either living with or have had breast cancer in Ohio right now.
Oh, wow. And how many people are supposed to be participating this week in Columbus?
We anticipate about 25,000 people will be downtown with us this
weekend. A little bit of a crowd, huh?
Yeah, it's really exciting. It's a really neat feeling to be down there and surrounded by all those survivors, patients, and their families, especially because, you know, we work so hard all year to deliver these programs, and we really love to feel that support from the community and know that we're going to be able to fund more programs because of it.
From 1996 to 2014, and I guess that's the latest year for which statistics are available,
right,
female breast cancer incident rates in Ohio were relatively stable, while mortality rates decreased slightly for both white and black women, but mortality statewide is 35% higher among African-American women.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Well, we think that, especially as I mentioned earlier, the mortality rate has gone down across the country, mm-hmm, and also, as you said, in Ohio, there is a mortality disparity, though, we see between black and white women. And what we think, what the theory is that a lot of the progress we've made has not been experienced equally by both groups. And that's the case in a lot of health disparities, especially health disparities that are affecting black and African-American women, that, you know, some of the latest progress, the latest treatments haven't always been disseminated equally and been experienced the same, especially when people have public insurance or maybe don't have all the resources to advocate for their treatment plans, adherence to the care that they've been prescribed, or barriers that get in the way, like social determinants of health, things like, you know, geography, where they live, bus routes to treatment. You know, how are we going to get you to that latest breakthrough? If we can't get you there, then you might not experience the benefit of it.
It sounds like it correlates along economic lines.
There is that correlation. We actually see that there's a delay in care for women between diagnosis and when they start their treatment for both women who are on Medicaid, so have public insurance. But we also see, independently of their Medicaid status and their insurance status, that black and African American women still have a persistent disparity regardless of economic status.
As far as when they start treatment, what do you know about that? Why is that happening?
There are some biological factors. We know that women of color, Latino women and Black and African American women are more likely to be diagnosed with kinds of breast cancer that are more aggressive and that we don't have as many treatments for. So Komen does invest a lot of money in research nationally. We're the largest funder besides the U.S. government of breast cancer research. And one of our big focuses is for women or to look at new therapies for those kinds of treatments that we don't have, or those kinds of breast cancer we don't have as many treatments for right now.
The number of cases of breast cancer tends to be higher in or near the big cities. What do we know about that?
That is a big mystery right now. That's something that the breast cancer profile that Ohio Department of Health published this past year. We have a surveillance system that looks at that kind of data in Ohio. And it's sort of a strange phenomena that we're not really sure what the reasons are for that. It may be something to do with just higher density of the population, more diagnoses happening because more women are getting screened.
They're more have better access to screenings and that kind of a thing.
That may be possible. And we do a lot of work in Southeast Ohio as well. And we do know that at least six of the counties that we serve have no on-site screening facilities. So we do a lot of work in trying to get people in those counties access to mobile screenings or
mammography machines is what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Why is that? I mean, why wouldn't a hospital in Southeast Ohio, why wouldn't there be a mammography machine?
Well, if there is a hospital, they most likely will have one.
Okay.
But there are at least six in our service area that do not have a hospital.
Okay.
So it's more that there's just not any access to any health care.
What about the environment? Has there been any thoughts about, toxicity of the environment?
Well, we know. So when you talk about cancer, a lot of it is environmental. And when we say environmental, we mean it's not inherited through your genes.
Okay.
So maybe you didn't inherit a genetic mutation, which, lots of people know about the BRCA mutations that increase breast cancer risk. But we say environmental, what we mean is that's some risk you've accumulated throughout your lifetime. And some of that may be things like toxicity in the air or also it could be lifestyle factors like exercise, alcohol use, hormone use. Postmenopausal hormones are a big risk factor for breast cancer. So there's been a lot of study, and actually Komen nationally did a big study, I think about 5 years ago, looking at environmental factors, which led to a national study by the government looking at environmental factors as well. A lot of it's still to be determined. It's really hard to isolate exactly what everyone has been exposed to. And breast cancer is very common. Only about 16 to 18% of breast cancer cases are in people who actually have a family history. So a lot of it is in that way determined as environmental for sure.
Are there ever pockets of breast cancer that's not related to genetic inheritance?
So that would be called a cluster.
Yeah, cluster, right.
Yeah. I haven't been exposed or seen of any clusters of breast cancer. I think normally when there is some sort of thing associated with, I think a lot of the times it's been plants or some sort of manufacturer that it has created an exposure.
And it's usually in a major organ.
Right. And typically that has not been manifested in breast cancer. And I don't have as much experience with that, but typically that shows up in brain or a leukemia lymphoma or a different kind of cancer.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the incidence of breast cancer in Ohio and around the country as well. My guest is Julie McMahon. She's Director of Mission and Strategy at the Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure Columbus affiliate. The race is this weekend on Saturday. For more information about that, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allside. You can also give us a call if you have a question, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. So tell us about the race, what happens, who goes, why they go, and how much money you expect to raise this year.
Well, I hope that we raise all the money that we need for all the programs that we know. We've definitely worked hard to create programs in our community, and we know that they're going to meet the needs that we've identified are contributing to people dying from breast cancer. So we're hoping to raise about $2 million, although if we can raise more than that, I know that we have good programs to fund with that if we can do it. The race is downtown on Saturday. The expo area where people can enjoy the vendors that'll be there opens at 8. And then we have a ceremony that'll start at 9 downtown. And then we have the 5K that starts at 9:45 and a 1 mile family walk people can enjoy that starts at 10 a.m.
And why do people go?
You know, we've talked to a lot of people this past year, and a lot of women who go when they've been diagnosed, and it's sort of the beginning of a family tradition for them to just reflect on, you know, that moment in their lives where they were really confronted with that breast cancer diagnosis and celebrate with their family that they were able to hopefully, you know, get through all the treatments and just really take a moment and honor that in their lives. And then it becomes a tradition that they enjoy with their families and they celebrate. And then for others who have unfortunately lost family members, it's, again, a time to really honor and remember that individual in their life. We have a remembrance wall, which we added a few years ago, where people can have a photo of someone that they have lost. And we can really take a moment to reflect on those people. And, you know, as it's really equally important that we think about those people who are survivors, and that is a celebration. But we also have a lot of women in our community who are dealing with breast cancer and, you know, will never end their treatment. They will never get to hear that they have ended their treatment. They're living with advanced disease, or people who have lost loved ones. And so we really are there to think about those women and really fight for them by funding programs and research that will hopefully get it to the point, like you mentioned earlier, where they just live with that disease for a long life.
How does the organization decide where the money goes and what research you invest in?
So we do a community needs assessment. And we talk to stakeholders and local healthcare facilities and really work closely with our partners to identify what the gaps in care are and where women might be falling through the cracks, where they might not be accessing care. And we try and then build programs in partnership with local partners to meet those needs. So, for example, we know that there's a state program that provides screenings. So we work with that program as well as hospital facilities to make sure that women are getting navigated to that program appropriately and getting offered all the resources that are available. As far as research goes, we have a goal as a national organization to reduce the number of breast cancer deaths by 50% in the next 10 years. Well, we're about 2 years into that, so about 8 years. And our research is really focused on that advanced disease stage and trying to find the treatments where if someone is diagnosed later, we have more to offer them and more tools in the toolbox to keep them thriving longer.
There are changes now in guidelines for screening. What's the latest? At least what does the Susan G. Komen organization subscribe to?
So Susan G. Komen has decided not to invest the hard, you know, all the hard effort that goes into fundraising in making yet another screening recommendation. There are already four or five bodies who have different recommendations like you're alluding to, and they all are slightly different. One recommends screening at 40, one's 45, one's 50. And we didn't feel like investing in making another screening recommendation was going to help that confusion. So what we advocate is a message where people know their personal risk, they know their family history, they talk to their doctor to figure out if they need to be getting screened earlier or later. So for example, I have a family history, and so I've talked to my doctor and they tell me when I should get screened. And that's going to be individual. It's going to be different. Women are all different. Women have different bodies. And so our recommendation is that people really know their risk and get screened personalized and individualized according to what that risk is.
A lot has changed since the Susan G. Komen started raising money 36 years ago, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And how has the organization changed the most over that time?
I think, you know, we've really moved towards everything we do is evidence-based. So, you know, we know that when people invest with us, they really are doing that because they have someone who they know and love who was affected by breast cancer. And we want to move the needle. We do not settle for, you know, just awareness anymore. That is really where it started. You couldn't talk about breast cancer 36 years ago. Now, people sometimes admit that they've seen too much pink and the awareness kind of issue is a little bit overdone to some people. And what we're really focused on is more than that, an action and making sure that where we identify there's a problem, we're actually building a solution and we're implementing that and actually making a difference and moving that mortality rate. So that's why we really put, you know, a flag in the sand on that a bit, a stake in the ground or what, whatnot. Uh-huh. And said, we want to impact the number of deaths in the next decade. And so things are urgent. You know, if you have someone who's going through breast cancer, you don't have years to wait to find new treatments for them. You want them now. And that's really what we're focused on.
Is there, though, I mean, what about experimental type of things, organic things, things that are below the radar maybe and aren't, you know, NIH, you know, stamp of approval?
Some of those things, it's going to be hard to ever, you know, prove if they work or not. So we really suggest that people use a lot of those things that aren't, quote, evidence-based as complementary therapies. So, you know, we're never going to recommend someone forego what we know can work and what there is evidence behind. But a lot of things are termed as integrative therapy. And so they're really good to do while you're going through the traditional therapies. Massage, yoga, we know really helps with people's healing. We actually were just talking yesterday about cold cap therapy, which is a way people can preserve their hair during chemotherapy treatments and not have the hair loss. And that actually has a benefit for your quality of life and your healing because you don't feel sick. So if you can preserve your hair, though, that doesn't have a medical benefit. Maybe you feel healthier and you can exercise and eat healthier while you're going through your treatment and have a better outcome.
You said that next to the government, the Susan G. Komen organization
funds the most
research. Mm-hmm. How much are we talking about?
It's almost $1 billion since we began. I think it's about $996 million right now, mm-hmm. Nationally. Mm-hmm. And it's a big, you know, we've come a long way. Some of that is research that's focused on finding better screenings. We have a local researcher at OSU who just developed a technology where they can identify circulating tumor cells in the blood. So a liquid biopsy for metastatic patients. We're looking at, you know, the biology of breast cancer. We're looking at that triple negative breast cancer I mentioned, new therapies, new combinations. A lot of the new breakthroughs are in areas where we're just combining drugs we already have, but finding that they work in a specific order better for some patients than others and things like that.
A lot of moving parts, but thank you, Julie McMahon, for joining us today to talk about them. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having us.
Julie McMahon, Director of Mission and Strategy at the Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure Columbus affiliate. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up. We're going to talk about vegetables and the foods to eat to avoid cancer, perhaps, in the future. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last week, the Ohio State Comprehensive Cancer Center, James Cancer Hospital, and Solove Research Institute launched the Mobile Education Kitchen. It's a food truck, one that nutrition experts at OSU will be taking on the road to not only educate the public about healthy cancer-preventing foods, but how to prepare them in tasty ways. Joining us now is the Program Director for Nutrition Services at Ohio State University Medical Center, Jim Warner. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Also joining us is clinical dietitian in the College of Education and Human Ecology at Ohio State, Natalie Stevens. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Natalie, when did this idea first occur to somebody? What's the genesis here?
Jim, I'm going to let him take over.
Yeah. Person to ask.
This actually started a couple of years ago through the Celebration for Life Fund, and we were asked by James' leadership to really reach for the sky in terms of what it was that we could do to help our community. And this mobile education kitchen, it was one of the ideas that came forward, and lo and behold, they funded it for us.
How big of a deal is the fact that people don't know how to cook food?
It's a huge deal. What you eat plays a really huge role in the big picture of cancer fighting and cancer prevention, and having access to those foods and knowing how to prepare them is a really big deal from the clinician standpoint.
Well, How do we know people don't know how to prepare food? How did you find this out?
Well, we've been doing community work for the last 10 or 12 years. And every time we go into a different community, whether it's the Hilltop, whether it's the South End, whether it's New Albany, there are so many deficits that we find, whether it's how to read labels, how to handle a knife, how to actually read a recipe. So no matter where we go, we see the same issues. So when we go out into the community, we really start at the very basics. And that way we give them a skill set that they can take with them as they progress through their through the challenges.
What you're doing when you go out with the food truck.
What we're trying to do is really promote plant-based foods, and we're promoting plant-based foods as it relates to cancer risk reduction, and that's one of the main focuses that we have with this with the James vehicle.
I saw a video of you demonstrating this the other day, and I'm always glad to hear. You know, it always reminds me that when your plate is colorful, the chances are you're
Absolutely.
Eating food that's good for you, unless it's Fruit Loops. Right?
Yeah. You would try to stay away from Fruit Loops.
Yeah, Fruit Loops bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
But natural foods, colorful.
Natural foods, most of the foods that we try to promote are really rich in what they consider phytochemicals that are plant-based in origin. And they're better for your body. They're easily digestible. And they're good for you.
There's so much more diversity in the produce section today, more than ever before, certainly more than when I was a kid. It's amazing, and yet people are using it less and less.
It goes back to that. I find from a lot of diet recall from patients in that they understand they need to eat healthy, but again, that knowledge deficit of when is a food ripe? When is it in season? When is it most economical to buy? And then when you buy it, how do you prepare it to make it taste good? The variety is there thanks to global market and trading and things like that. But it doesn't mean that it's always being purchased and used in the way that would have the best benefit.
Are kids getting in on this at all?
We've done some community events that relate to school-age children. And those have gone very, very well because the kids really don't know the difference between what's good food and what's not such good food for them. So whenever we go into the different communities with children, we break it down to real easy things that they can do on their own with yogurt, with granola, with dried fruits, with fresh fruits, so they can take those things home to their parents, and then hopefully they'll teach their parents that, hey, I like these foods, and their parents will go out and buy them for the children.
How do you schedule where the food truck goes? What are you shooting for?
Well, for this particular vehicle, we hope to do at least 2 to 3 a week. And we have the website, which is the cancer.osu.edu website that will take you to the food truck. And then you'll have an email address associated with that. And what we do is look at the cost and look at the need for what people have for the vehicle. And at that point, we determine the need, and then we move forward at that point.
Who pays for it?
The James has Celebration for Life has paid for the vehicle. There is a nominal charge associated with us going out in the vehicle.
Do you feed people?
Oh, absolutely. We offer people knife skills, how to read labels. We have 2 TV monitors on the side of the vehicle that we videotape the actual chef in the truck, and then we broadcast that on the outside of the truck so people actually see what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
And then we provide the same food that he's preparing on the vehicle to the participants that are there with us at the vehicle.
Prep is a big important thing. I mean, kale's great, but deep fried kale probably not so much. So what do we understand about people's shortcomings when it comes to the prep?
Oh,
is it? I know sometimes, particularly with low income people, it's they don't have the tools.
Well, a lot of times they don't have the tools or they don't have the facilities to prepare the food. We did an event on the Hilltop area, and we were talking to one gentleman about how we could make it easier for him to prepare the foods. And he told me that all he had in his apartment was a dorm-sized refrigerator, a hot plate, and one pot. And that was one of the aha moments that whenever we go into the different communities, we don't take a Vitamix or we don't take a food processor because they don't have these types of equipment. Mm-hmm. But if we're going to go into Upper Arlington or New Albany, we know that they're going to be more suited to having these more expensive kitchen items.
Well, so which brings me to the question of, is there a problem with this in Upper Arlington and New Albany as well?
Yeah. household income doesn't mean that patients know how or clients know how to prepare meals. A lot of times in the affluent areas, dining out is easy. There's no cleanup. Things taste great. And so those skills of the kitchen skills are still lacking even in affluent areas.
And then generationally, it's getting worse and worse, I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't stand in the kitchen with your mom, if you only know that you go eat lunch at a restaurant or the club, mm-hmm. You're not building skills with, you know, generation to generation.
Does this help people choose what to eat if they are going to be eating out as well? Is that a piece of this?
Not necessarily. We're really trying to focus on giving them the skill sets that they need to really help their own health outcome. And we don't really get too involved with what they should eat in restaurants, although we will discuss that. Mm-hmm. Every restaurant offers something different. And most restaurant foods are high in salt, high in fat, high in sugar. And most people would rather go to a restaurant than spend time preparing a good meal for their family. And what we're trying to do is show people that they can prepare food in a timely manner, in a healthy fashion, and feed their family the way they should.
A lot of now a lot of restaurants, big chain restaurants, have to provide caloric content and that kind of a thing. That's an improvement, but that's not really what you're talking about when it comes to healthy foods.
Calories are important. One of the AICR guidelines recommends, healthy weight and controlled weight. And the CDC says that overweight and obesity are associated with an increased risk of 13 types of cancer. So controlling your calorie intake is a big deal in terms of cancer prevention and risk reduction. Just depends on the choices that you're going to make. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, just the simple, colorful plate. If you can focus on things like that, the My Plate method is half your plate fruits and veggies with your meal. If that's the case, you're probably making good strides towards risk reduction.
So tell us about some of the meals that you prepare, some of the recipes that you use.
Well, most of the recipes that we use, and we're trying to develop some recipes that combine some of the pre-prepped foods that you might find in grocery stores, like the rice cauliflower, some of the cut Brussels sprouts, things like that. So it's more like speed scratch is what we tend to call it, where we're actually using the foods that are processed to a degree, but then we add different ingredients to the foods that are better for them. Mm-hmm. So it takes less time for people to cook, because that's the one thing that we find, that people are really time crunched. And when they're time crunched, they're going to spend less time preparing good food, going out to eat, bringing home this food that's not so good for mm-hmm. them. So we're basically giving them the tools that they need to provide good meals for their family.
In a practical way that makes sense for them.
So.
And what has the reception been so far?
Well, it's been fantastic. We had an event on Saturday evening, and we poached some parsnips. And the way we poached them and the way we fried them, they look like scallops. And people come over to our table thinking that they were scallops, and we told them that they were parsnips. And they're going, "You got to be kidding me. I've never had
poached?
A parsnip in my..." Yes.
I love parsnips,
but
I've never poached them.
They were fantastic. And we told them what they were, and the response was, "I've never had a parsnip in my entire life," or "I've never had Swiss chard in my entire life." So it's kind of an eye-opening experience, because the individuals that we were speaking to were certainly on the higher end of the economic spectrum, mm-hmm. and we would have thought differently. But the case was that they had not tried these foods. So for us, it was a teaching moment, and for them, it was a learning moment as well.
Okay, tell me how you poach a parsnip.
We poached it in light vegetable stock, and what
so
we
you,
did with
you
that—
So you slice it into the—
We slice it into rounds so
rounds,
they look like
right.
scallops,
okay.
and then we grilled it on both sides so it looked like a crispy scallop, and then we served that in a vegetable reduction. And then the vegetable reduction was a little bit thickened. And then we topped that with some honey pearls and some pea sprouts. It looked amazing.
So when you poach this, you cut it into rounds, like what, like an inch and a half?
Probably we want it to look like a scallop. So you want to cook them about or cut them about a half inch or 1.5 inches
and the fat
around,
ends,
because
parsnips
an
are famous for being very skinny and then
yes,
very fat.
But you
want to
cut toward the fatter
right.
of the parsnip.
And then you poach them for how long?
Until you can run a toothpick through them. And then once we poach them, we chill them. And after they're chilled, we'll put them on a grill, and then we'll brown them on both sides. The natural sugar
right.
that's in the parsnip will caramelize, and we'll give it a lot of flavor. And then the sauce that we add to that with the honey pearls and then with the pea sprouts, it just was fantastic.
Do you thicken the sauce with the other parts of the parsnip?
Well, what we did is we took a large variety of vegetables and we reduced the vegetables down to it was a really thickened sauce.
Yeah.
And the natural pectin that was in the fruits and in the vegetables is what thickened the sauce. So we had no flour. It was a gluten-free dish.
Wow.
It was amazing.
I'm hungry. It's almost 12 o'clock. What are some other things you do?
We ran a dish the other day where we had Swiss chard, we had asparagus, a lot of different spring vegetables that we mixed with a little bit of pasta. But the lion's share of the dish was vegetables with just a little bit of pasta. And we cooked out with olive oil, a little bit of garlic, some fresh asparagus, Swiss chard leaves, and some baby tomatoes, and just tossed that around in a single pot. And it was very well received. It was delicious.
Give us some ideas about condiments that are good, that are healthy, other than salt and pepper.
What we try to push, or in terms of condiments,
yeah,
we really try to push with fresh herbs on people. And fresh herbs are a way to add a maximum amount of flavor with some nutritional value to it as well. As far as other condiments, we try to stay away from ketchup because of the sugar
all
content,
of them have
the
sugar,
salt
right,
content.
Yeah.
There aren't a whole lot of condiments that I can really think of that would be suitable for what we're dealing with. Natalie?
Well, so it's a side tangent, but I just heard from Dr. Chris Taylor at The Ohio State University last week at a conference talking about NHANES data and the significance of calories from condiments. And the dietetics community, we really push, no mayo, no mustard, no ketchup. Remove all the, reduce your salad dressing. But in reality, people are not consuming that many calories from those types of foods. It's really, sugar-sweetened beverages or non-alcoholic beverages that people are getting the bulk of their calories from. And so it was an aha moment for me as a clinician to say, maybe condiments aren't such a big deal. If it's going to help get those vegetables down, I might need to relax my tone on those
right.
foods.
Right. And speaking of what we drink, is there any idea? Do you have any ideas about changing that up? There's such an the pop, the soda thing is still such a big problem.
It really is. A lot of our events we take along with us a spa water, so we'll take water and we'll mix it with strawberries and mint or ginger and pear. We make all sorts of different combinations based on what we have on hand, and we take that along with this. And people actually love it because it's very refreshing, and it's virtually sugar-free.
They're delicious.
When you do ginger, do you prepare the ginger? Or do you just peel it and slice it?
We peel it and slice it, or we puree it a little bit so that way it dissipates a little bit more in the liquid.
Right. That's what I was wondering. Another wonderful food that goes into a lot of different dishes nowadays. So what are you hoping? How do you measure success when it comes to something like this? What are you shooting for, Natalie Stevens?
To see behavior change.
And how are you going to know it does?
So from a clinician standpoint, when I'm one-on-one with a patient and I ask, tell me about what you ate yesterday, or ask for patterns, how often are you going out to eat or making food at home? If we can see an increase in food consumption at home and a report of more fruit and vegetable intake, that plant-based lifestyle is really, there's plenty of research behind it. We really need to increase the plant-based lifestyle. So if we can get some of that report back, influence one person's life and have that spread through their family, that would be an amazing mark.
Yeah. And what about you, Jim?
I think one of my favorite success stories was that we were working with the Columbus Bilingual Academy, and they had a vendor that was providing school lunches to them. And we were there for a period of about 8 weeks in a row. And after the eighth or ninth week, they really learned that every time we came in, they gained we gained their trust. Mm-hmm. So by the end of the 9 weeks, we had found out that they fired their existing food service provider and brought one in that actually provided fresh fruits and vegetables to their students. So that was, in terms of success, we can't ask for anything more than that.
Because they were getting the kind of feedback from the kids that
the kids, they loved
them.
It.
Yeah. And now I get it that you go back over and over again to certain sites.
Yeah. And a lot of times, especially when we go into to communities, if you go in there once, you tend to sound a little bit preachy.
Yeah.
But if you're back there three, four, and five times, they learn to trust you and learn to trust the word that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then they're more prone to make changes in their diet or their lifestyle because you're there every week and you have their best interest in mind.
Jim Warner, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Jim Warner is Program Director of Nutrition Services at Ohio State University Medical Center. Also, Natalie Stevens, thanks for your help as well.
Thanks for having us.
Natalie Stevens is Clinical Dietitian for the College of Education and Human Ecology at Ohio State. That's it for Wellness Wednesday. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.